Welcome to Washington Today for Friday, March 18th, 2022. I'm Nkoyo Iyamba. Here are some of today's headlines. President Joe Biden and China's Xi Jinping spoke for nearly 2 hours on Friday as the White House looked to deter Beijing from providing military or economic assistance for Russia's invasion of Ukraine. China's foreign ministry was the first to issue a readout of the video conversation, deploring, quote, conflict and confrontation as not in anyone's interest, without assigning any blame to Russia. We'll have more on this in a moment. Russian President Vladimir Putin appeared at a flag-waving rally at a packed Moscow stadium Friday. Mr. Putin lavished praise on his troops fighting in Ukraine. That's 3 weeks into the invasion that has led to heavier-than-expected Russian losses on the battlefield and increasingly authoritarian rule at home. Meanwhile, Russian TV, state TV, confirmed Friday that one of its top commanders died in Ukraine. CNN is reporting that Russian television network GTRK Kostroma confirms that Colonel Sergei Sukarev, commander of the elite 331st Guards Airborne Regiment, died, along with several other members of the unit. India, the world's most populous democracy, is challenging the U.S.'s campaign to unite the globe against the Russian invasion in Ukraine. On condition of anonymity, an Indian government official said India bought 3 million barrels of Russian oil to help its economy recover from the coronavirus pandemic. Several European allies, such as Germany, have also continued to buy oil from Russia. We'll have more on that in a moment. We begin at the United Nations in New York City, where Russian Ambassador to the UN, Vasily Nebenzia, spoke at the UN Security Council meeting on Ukraine. The Russian ambassador continued allegations of U.S., quote, biological laboratories in Ukraine, claiming Russia has new documents.
Over the last week, new details have come to light, which allow us to state that the components for biological weapons were being created on the territory of Ukraine. The implementation of the aforementioned American-Ukrainian agreement from 2005, and comments on which we're still waiting for from the U.S. representation, has been going full steam ahead for all these years. However, from the document we can see that the American colleagues were not helping, as they claim, the Ukrainian Ministry of Health, but rather the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense. The Security Council document that we distributed this morning, and you see in that material, you can see the so-called technical assistance plan for certain recipients of the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense. I recommend you to look at this document very carefully.
Russian Ambassador to the UN, Vasily Nebenzia, through translator. In response to those statements, the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, made these remarks.
And last week, we heard from the Russian representative a tirade of bizarre conspiracy theories. This week, we're hearing a whole lot more where that came from, things that sound like they were forwarded to him on a chain email from some dark corner of the internet. President Biden has a word for this kind of talk, malarkey. As I said 1 week ago, Ukraine does not have a biological weapons program. There are no Ukrainian biological weapons laboratories, not near Russia's border, not anywhere. There are only public health facilities, proudly, and I say proudly, supported and recognized by the U.S. government, the World Health Organization, and other governments and international institutions. In fact, it is Russia that has long maintained a biological weapons program in violation of international law. It is Russia that has a well-documented history of using chemical weapons. It is Russia who is the aggressor here. It was Russian operatives who poisoned Alexei Navalny and Sergei and Yulia Skripal with nerve agents. It is Russia that continues to support the Assad regime in Syria and shield it from accountability when the UN and the OPCW have confirmed that Assad has recently used chemical weapons over the past several years. Let's not forget why we are really here today. We're here because Russia knew its cynical ploy to pass an exculpatory resolution had failed. This meeting is the result of their isolation on this council and on the world stage. We're not buying what they're selling, literally or figuratively. And I will reiterate the United States' deep and serious concern that Russia's calling for this meeting is a potential false flag effort in action. Russia has repeatedly accused other countries of the very violations it plans to perpetrate. We continue to believe it is possible that Russia may be planning to use chemical or biological agents against the Ukrainian people. We aren't going to dignify Russia's disinformation or conspiracy theories, but we will continue to sound the alarm and tell the world where we think Russia is heading. And we will remind the world that Russia has repeatedly lied to this council over recent weeks.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield at the U.N. Security Council. After the U.N. Security Council meeting, Russian Ambassador to the U.N., Vasily Nebenzia, along with the Russian First Deputy Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Dmitry Polyansky, made these remarks to reporters.
Our partners are in complete denial. They won't listen to what we're saying. They won't accept that we are presenting facts and not just propaganda. We circulated new materials about the issue among the Security Council members and the General Assembly. And I'm sure that you will be able to get access to those documents. They are not confidential or secret. And you will make your own mind whether it's propaganda and unsubstantiated accusations, or whether these are documents that are worth commenting and replying, which we didn't hear today. Today we heard the repetition of what they said, of what our partners said in the meeting of the 11th of March. They refused to accept and to recognize that we presented new set of evidence of military biological programs that were conducted in Ukraine with the participation of Pentagon. And now I would like to give the floor to my first deputy to make a special announcement.
Yes, hello everybody. I just wanted to announce that my Twitter was blocked today, and I received a message from the client service saying that I am violating the rules of Twitter. And I'm engaged in abuse and harassment. So the tweet is like this. That's how fake news is born. We warned in our statement back on 7 March that the hospital in Mariupol has been turned into a military object by radicals. Very disturbing that UN spreads this information without verification. That was my tweet. So it's abuse and harassment, according to Twitter. I will open account in Telegram, and you will receive English version link to this account. This is very deplorable, and this clearly illustrates how much alternative view and free press and free information is valued by Twitter and in this country. Thank you very much.
This is a new interpretation of the word harassment as well.
Thank you.
Speaking to reporters after the UN Security Council meeting, Russian First Deputy Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Dmitry Polyansky, along with Russian Ambassador to the UN, Vasily Nebenzia. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., President Joe Biden and China's Xi Jinping spoke for nearly 2 hours Friday as the White House looked to deter Beijing from providing military or economic assistance for Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Here's White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki responding to reporters' questions about that call.
I'm not going to give an assessment of that from here. What I can tell you is that the majority of this call, as I think you heard, you saw in the readout and you heard, I think, on the call we just did, but was focused on Russia's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine. The president spent the vast majority of the nearly 2 hours was spent with the president outlining the views of the United States and our allies and partners on this crisis, including a detailed overview of efforts to prevent and then respond to the invasion, how we got here, steps we've taken, where we've gone and why. And of course, as was also noted in the readout, but let me just reiterate, he also conveyed and described the implications and consequences if China provides material support to Russia. But again, I'm not going to provide any additional assessment from here.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki also responded to questions about India and other European allies continuing to purchase oil from Russia.
Does the White House have any response to India's purchases there? And does the president plan to reach out to the Indian government to try to get that decision reversed?
Well, we have not. Well, we made a decision about banning the Russian import of oil. Every country has not made that decision, and we recognize that. And they have different economic reasoning as to why different countries do, including some in Europe. We have been in touch, of course, with Indian leaders at a range of levels, not through the president. If that happens, we will, of course, provide that readout and information to all of you. But what we would project or convey to any leader around the world is that the rest of the world is watching where you're going to stand as it relates to this conflict, whether it's support for Russia in any form as they are illegally invading Ukraine.
From the White House James Brady Briefing Room, Press Secretary Jen Psaki speaking to reporters. We now go to the Pentagon, where outgoing head of U.S. Central Command General Frank McKenzie spoke to reporters for the final time in his role. He responded to questions on Russia's military operation in Ukraine.
General McKenzie, you have had, of course, quite a good deal of experience with understanding Russian forces in Syria. So I'll limit it to that. Can you give us, as you conclude all of this, your sense recently of those Russian forces in Syria? Do they have frontline equipment? Do they have food? Do they have fuel? Do their commanders look after them? Are they a top-notch fighting force in Syria? And I know you've also spoken a little bit, but could you regroup for us your latest thoughts about Russian mercenaries in Syria, the extent to which the Russians may be either using Wagner or recruiting in Syria to move into Ukraine? Thank you.
Thanks, Barbara. So over the 3 years of my command of CENTCOM, we have generally had a brisk, professional deconfliction relationship with the Russians in Syria. We can always contact them if we have a problem. They'll always pick up the phone, and we feel that we respond in kind to them. So that relationship has been very, very professional. I will tell you that they do have good equipment. I mean, we've seen first echelon fighter aircraft down there. We've seen bombers come in and out of their air base in western Syria. My observation is that writ large, the one thing the Russians don't have, which is sort of the key of the U.S. joint force, is the middle management level, the NCO and staff non-commissioned officer level that really form the backbone of our military. They're the people that actually ensure things get done, that people are fed properly, that people have a warm place to sleep at night, all of those things. I just don't believe they're as good at that as we are. And you can draw your own larger conclusions, which I'm really not the person to talk about their operations in Ukraine and what it means for their level of small unit training and small unit effectiveness, which I would again note is the pride really of the U.S. military, our ability to have junior leaders execute independently. That is, I think, something that sets us apart from most militaries in the world, and we stress that as a point of emphasis, and we're very proud of it. You asked about mercenaries in Syria and recruiting. We've seen little evidence of recruiting in Syria to bring people back to Ukraine. Not saying it couldn't happen, and I'm not saying that one or two or three or four haven't gone, but we haven't seen any large-scale effort to do that. There is something of a Wagner presence in Syria, but it's actually relatively small, and we don't actually interact much with them. You may recall back in the first half of 2018, a Wagner group attempted to attack American forces down around Deir ez-Zor and resulted in a significant defeat for them with a number of casualties numbering in the hundreds. And that's an object lesson that they should probably ponder in Syria as they go forward. Thanks, Barbara.
That's outgoing head of U.S. Central Command General Frank McKenzie. Speaking of military strategies, Arkansas Republican Senator Tom Cotton was the keynote speaker at the 2022 Lincoln Day Dinner in Pittsburgh, hosted by the Republican Committee of Allegheny County. Senator Cotton spoke on the 2021 withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan and the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
We were humiliated in front of the world in Afghanistan because of Joe Biden's incompetence. What's worse, we lost 13 brave troopers who should have never been there. And is it any surprise that a month after Kabul fell, Vladimir Putin began to mass forces on Ukraine's border? Because weakness is provocative. He saw what had happened in Afghanistan, in addition to what had been happening since the day Joe Biden took office, a series of weak, one-sided concessions, whether it was a bad arms control treaty, or that gas pipeline running to Germany, or a fancy summit in Europe, or the refusal to retaliate for cyber attacks on the Colonial Pipeline and other critical infrastructure. And he thought, Joe Biden can't stand up to a depraved 7th century band of savages in Afghanistan. There's no way he can stand up to a nuclear-armed Russia in Europe. And unfortunately, for months, he didn't. We saw in September and October and November and December and January the buildup of those forces. It may not have been public. You may not have known it, but I promise you, we knew it. And we never signaled to Russia that we wouldn't stand for it. All those weapons were rushing to Ukraine right now. We didn't rush there in all those months. All those sanctions that we've imposed on Russia, we didn't impose then. Every step of the way, every step, President Biden signaled that we would stand idly by while Russia invaded a sovereign nation of 45 million souls. And unfortunately, that's exactly what happened 3 weeks ago. Now, I welcome some of the steps he's taken since then, but I have to say he is still pussyfooting around, hemming and hawing, hedging and trimming, not sharing intelligence, okay, then sharing a little bit more, providing anti-tank missiles, but not providing anti-aircraft missiles, telling Ukraine that it's A-okay if Poland gives you those MiG aircraft, but it would be a dangerous provocation if the United States gave them to you. How does that figure? It's exactly the logic he had all last fall and winter. We can't send weapons to Ukraine because if we do, Vladimir Putin might invade. How foolish does it look in retrospect? Every step of the way, President Biden has been dragged, kicking and screaming, to do what we should have done weeks ago, whether it was by President Zelensky, or the bravery of the Ukrainian people, or Republicans, or the Congress, and it's still happening. And if he won't take the steps necessary, then I promise you, I and Republicans in the Congress will. We will make sure Ukraine can defend itself.
Arkansas Republican Senator Tom Cotton. A trio of Russian cosmonauts arrived at the International Space Station on Friday, the first new faces in space since the start of the Russian war in Ukraine on February 24th. The war has resulted in canceled spacecraft launches and broken contracts. But NASA Administrator Bill Nelson has stated that they're all working well together and that they have a, quote, cooperation with our Russian friends, our colleagues, end quote. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today. Here are more headlines. White House advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci is warning that COVID-19 infection rates are likely to rise in the next few weeks in the United States. This update, even after seeing dramatic drops in infection rates following the Omicron variant's rapid spread across the country. Toyota and other semiconductor-using companies are suspending operations in Japan after a 7.3-magnitude earthquake hit the country this week. The production lines will be down for 3 weeks. Iran has converted a fraction of its stockpile of highly enriched uranium into material crucial for detecting cancers and other diseases. That's according to the UN nuclear watchdog and an Iranian media report. Iran's decision to convert the uranium takes it out of a form that can potentially be further refined into weapons-grade levels. The development comes as talks in Vienna over restoring Tehran's nuclear deal with world powers hang in the balance. We continue now in the U.S. House, where House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy spoke to reporters about a number of issues, including one House member who called Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky a thug.
All right, go ahead.
One of your colleagues, Madison Cawthorn, called Zelensky a thug. He also suggested they're pushing disinformation. Have you spoken to him, and
yes.
Do you support his reelection?
Madison is wrong. If there's any thug in this world, it's Putin. You just watched Putin with Russia directing Russia bomb maternity ward. We watched yesterday in a theater that's identified in the front and the back from the air that you're housing children. Bomb. This is atrocious. This is wrong. This is the aggressor. This is the one that needs to end this war. This is the one that everybody should unite against.
You support Israeli?
Yes.
House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy also answered questions on COVID relief funding.
Yes, sir.
Do you think, so they had to pull their COVID relief from the omnibus last week.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think...
Brilliant move on their part.
Do you think that... you need more COVID? I mean, what's your view right now?
Look, there's certain things you need to deal with COVID, and the unique part is it, there's plenty of money already out there that has already been appropriated, more than $300 billion. You don't need $300 billion worth of new COVID items. They even admit that. The money's already appropriated and hasn't been spent. That's where they should use it. The challenge is their progressives and their socialists in the party only want to spend more. So they've created this problem themselves, and they created an issue that they're going to have a hard time solving.
House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has been making the case for why Democrats are pushing for COVID relief spending. Here's what the House Speaker said to reporters on Thursday.
Madam Speaker, two quick questions on COVID. First, on the COVID funding. Yesterday, Chair Jeffries suggested that you have time until September to act on a relief package. Is that your view? Are you going to take your time with this, or do you want to do something sooner rather than later? And then just with respect to the dinner last night, can you say roughly how long you were sitting next to the Tisich, and do you have any concerns about your health at this point?
No, I don't. And I get tested almost every day anyway because, says she immodestly, many times I see the president, and you have to be tested to do that. And really, for the safety of my colleagues with whom I come in contact. The Taoiseach had on a mask when he sat down, but then when he started to eat, he took off the mask. And then, was right during the appetizer, they took him, called him aside. We didn't know why. Sometime later, when it was my turn to speak, they told me how we would proceed, that he would not be speaking. So I wasn't measuring it minutes, but part of it was masked, some of it while he was eating, but it was during the appetizer that they took him away. I think we need all the money we can get to have the resources that we need to fight COVID. The last thing we need is another variant. The resources that we would have had in the bill, I think, need to be enhanced now because we're another week later and we still don't have it. You know the history. In the beginning, we had these therapies, which were the vaccines, which were in sub-zero ice temperature, ice protection with a short shelf life. And that was a fragile therapy. But it worked. And now we have pills that come in a box that can last a long time. You can take at the onset if you feel a symptom, and it can prevent it from going forward. What's important about that and why we need that money is because you want to stop transmission. Transmission creates variants. Variants are different, and they present, if they are different, present different challenges. So this is nothing to mess with. I think we need even more money than they had, than the compromise was. The Republicans did not want to spend money on COVID, and they don't like the state funding. So we took some of the state funding, only half for the money. I was very disappointed, I have to be very honest with you, because we need the money to buy the pills. The pills exist, the science is there, but there's a market out there as well beyond the U.S. And we have a responsibility to other countries. So I think we have to get on with it. I respect what the distinguished chair said about, well, we have time. Well, we have a little. But we need more. The more time we have, the more money we need.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi speaking to reporters Thursday during her weekly press briefing. The headline at Politico.com, "We need this money. COVID funding stalls as Congress, White House point fingers." On the phone to explain the latest on COVID funding relief is Politico healthcare reporter Alice Miranda Olstein. What's the hurdle right now in getting COVID funds?
So there are a few different hurdles. Really, the challenge came after House Democrats decided to decouple the COVID funding from the rest of the massive government spending bill that also included military aid for Ukraine that recently passed. And now the effort to try to pass the COVID funding on its own is running into a lot of challenges. Again, in the House, Democrats, as well as Republicans, are fighting over how much of the COVID funding to pay for through other sources and what those other sources should be. The disagreement came after House leadership decided to take some of the funding from unspent coronavirus aid to states that had been approved in previous congressional bills. States that were set to lose some of that money strenuously objected, and now we are in this stalemate. Meanwhile, over in the Senate, so it's important for folks to remember that this would need at least 10 Republican votes in order to get 60 Senate votes to pass. There are a lot of Republicans who say, we're not convinced this is needed at all. You know, a lot of Republicans recently voted to declare the pandemic emergency over. And so they're really not eager to spend a bunch more money. So the White House and some members of Congress who support this are trying to make the case that it's really dangerous to let some of these government coronavirus programs expire both in the U.S. and around the world because it would leave the population vulnerable to future surges or future variants.
Now, how are Democrats explaining their decoupling of this bill? I heard one Republican on the House floor use the term bait and switch.
So, again, this is about where the funding should come from. So Republicans have insisted that the entire amount be paid for through other sources. And so that led to a scramble to try to find those other sources. And one source they settled on was this unspent aid to states. But again, the Democrats who come from the states that were set to lose the most of that money said, we will absolutely not vote for this if you go forward with this. And so now they are sort of back to the drawing board and scrambling to try to find a path forward.
But there are some Republicans that support President Biden's request for more COVID funding. What are you hearing from them?
Right, absolutely. So there are Republicans in the House and Senate who say that they are convinced this funding is needed. They don't want to see, you know, for example, programs to send more vaccines overseas cut off. They are understanding of the threat to the termination of some of the free programs in the United States for vaccination, for testing, for disease surveillance. But they say they have not gotten enough help from the Biden administration to make that case to their colleagues. So as you referenced in my story, there is sort of this round of finger pointing going on, which so often happens in D.C., where the White House is saying it's Congress's job to get this done. And Congress is saying the White House is not giving us a plan or a strategy to get it done.
And what are economic advisors and experts recommending?
So again, the focus now is to be prepared for a potential future surge or a future variant. We've seen what has happened over the past few years when people relax too soon, drop all precautions, and are sort of caught unawares when there are new surges. And there are warning signs coming from overseas. We're seeing cases already go up in some European countries. And there are also warning signs here in the U.S. Scientists who study wastewater in order to track COVID rates are seeing a potential uptick. And so there are warning that it'll be much more expensive to try to respond to a surge when it's already happening rather than prepare for it in advance. And so there are these fights going on about, the White House is asking for about $22.5 billion. Previously, they had been talking about a little over $15 billion, but they're saying it'll cost way more if we don't approve this funding now and if we are sort of trying to play catch up later on.
And what's the latest from healthcare administrators on boosters and the pandemic?
So an important thing to remember about this funding is if there is another recommendation for a fourth shot or another booster or however they want to frame it, there might not be the funding to get those boosters out there and to provide them for free to people. So this is really threatening the future of the COVID response, both in the U.S. and overseas. And that is not quite unsticking things on Capitol Hill quite yet.
So where do we stand now in the process in order to move forward?
I'll just say, the House originally said they were going to vote this week. They did not. They are out all next week. And so the delays are mounting and it really has very immediate term effects. The government is already saying they are having to cancel orders of COVID therapeutic drugs that are very expensive if people would have to buy them out of pocket themselves. And so the urgency is there, but that doesn't always translate into congressional action.
The headline at Politico.com, "We need this money. COVID funding stalls as Congress White House point fingers." You can find that headline at Politico.com with healthcare reporter Alice Miranda Olstein. Thank you so much for explaining all of this to us.
Thank you.
Three doses of the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines were 94% effective in preventing death or the need for a ventilator during the Omicron surge. That's according to a new study from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The findings were based on results from 21 medical centers in 18 states. A reminder that all of our coverage is online anytime at cspan.org. And if you've missed any of this program, you can find it on cspan.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, if you'd like more on the stories that are shaping Washington delivered daily right to your inbox, you can subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter word for word. Just go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe. I'm Nkoyo Iyamba. Thanks for listening today to Washington Today.